Our second case this morning is United States against Smith. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Ronald Major on behalf of Appellant Webster Smith. In this matter, Appellant Smith was charged with 7 sex-related counts. He was convicted on 3. And on each of those 3, he was deprived his constitutional right to present critical cross-examination into the accuser's bias and in the depths of her motivation to fabricate. The defense's theory of the case was that the accuser had a motive to fabricate in order to protect her career.
Counsel, before you get into your theory of the case, would you address the government's jurisdictional argument, which you don't address in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor. The jurisdictional argument being that we don't have jurisdiction because the...
That this court has no jurisdiction under Rodriguez.
Well, Your Honor, I think under the Sparks case, it's clear that there's case precedent that the motion for reconsideration tolls the statutory period by which a petition for review has to be filed. Rodriguez and Bowles dealt with ad hoc decisions by courts to extend the deadline for filing. They did not deal with this sort of situation where you have a court-mandated rule that the court is promulgated under statutory authority to implement in order to manage its affairs, which allows for the timely filing of the petition for review after the motion for reconsideration is determined. Your Honors, it was especially significant that this cross be allowed in this case because the defense theory of the case was that the accuser had the motive to fabricate in order to protect her career.
Can I interrupt you for a moment to see whether something's still on the table or not? In paragraph 3 of the conclusions of law of the military judge, the judge says, the defense also argued that the members must know the substance of the cadet's secret in order for them to independently assess whether or not she would feel coerced into doing the various things that he was charged with. Is that part of your theory today? Have you abandoned that theory? You don't argue it in your brief. Is that theory on the table or not with respect to your appeal?
It certainly is. I mean, if the secret in this case was that the accuser had lied about in recent times about a prior consensual encounter being non-consensual, there was a very close nexus, a very close link between that proposed line of cross and the defense's theory of the case.
Where is that theory raised and preserved, if it's necessary to preserve in the record? The military judge picked up on it, but I don't see it in the joint appendix, and it may be somewhere else in the rather large record here. What pages would you cite as the pages that defense counsel is raising that issue and bringing it to the attention of the judge?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Clearly they did, because the judge picked up on it.
Yeah, I can't give you a case site right now. I know there.
Well, how about a page site? I'm looking for a trial record site.
Well, that's what I'm saying, a joint appendix site. I can't give you that right now, but I know that there was a lot of back and forth about this issue, and it was clear that defense counsel was raising that his theory was that this secret had to be revealed, that there was a non-consensual encounter, that the appellant, that the accuser had claimed was non-consensual.
Because you've answered my question, which is that's still in play as far as you're concerned.
Yes.
You're welcome. I'm done with my question.
Okay.
But you can back to you.
Thank
okay.
You.
The judge did allow the fact that she lied, or she allegedly lied, and that she did it to protect her career in. That was in, right?
That's right.
So the only thing that wasn't in was the exact circumstances about what she lied, assuming she did
That's
lie.
Right. And that was critical in this case.
Okay, and how is it critical? Isn't this, didn't the judge try and craft a remedy that was consistent with both 412 and the accused's interests in this case?
I think he tried, but he erred in a number of respects.
Okay, how?
First, he minimized the probative value of this evidence. The probative value of this evidence was extremely high. The fact that the accuser had lied under similar circumstances, that she had an inclination to claim consensual encounters were non-consensual when those encounters were about to become public, was critical evidence that I think it's beyond a shadow of a doubt nobody can claim they would not have had an effect on the members' member's determination of her credibility.
But didn't the military judge find that the situations were not similar? I mean, didn't the military judge find that the situations were not precisely similar? And that, in addition to the fact that the sole source of this information was from the accused, together led him to believe that the probative value was low.
That's right. And we think that was a flawed determination as well.
Well, I understand that you disagree with the determination, but how is it an abuse of discretion?
Well, it's an abuse of discretion because this court's precedent has clearly held that the defense should have wide latitude when cross-examining biased and motive evidence, especially in a case like this where the government's case depends on one witness, where the government's case is razor thin. The evidence of blackmail in this case was as thin as it could get. There was not even an explicit threat that the appellant had made that the accused should give him sexual favors in order for him to suppress the rumors. It all depended upon subtle phrases and perceptions of the accuser. In that sort of case, I think it's clear, and this case's most recent decision in Collier makes that very clear, that cross-examination should be allowed. In the Collier case, cross-examination was prohibited into the fact that the accused claimed that she had a homosexual relationship with the accuser. What the court found was that cross should have been allowed because there's a real distinction between the motivations of an angry lover to fabricate and the motivations of a disgruntled friend. In this case, it's...
Yeah, but the judge in Collier clamped down a good deal more than the judge here. The judge in Collier didn't allow any inquiry into the what happened, and the judge here allowed fairly substantial inquiry into everything but the exact nature of the secret.
I would respectfully disagree. I think the judge in Collier allowed a lot more cross than was allowed here. The judge in Collier allowed cross into the fact that the accuser had a crush on the accused. I mean, that the accused had a crush on the accuser, that there was a very close relationship that had become untwined. Here, all that the members heard was that the accuser had lied in the past about some secret, or lied in the past about some fact that had a general ability to have an impact on her career. What they were prevented from knowing was that lie was that a prior sexual encounter was non-consensual. And that not only that, but that she not only lied about it to appellant, but then she allowed the appellant, this is a finding of fact by the military judge, to go out and discuss that lie with others, claim that consensual encounter was non-consensual. So it's not only the fact that she lied, but she allowed him to lie about it when she thought that was going to become public.
There are a variety of secrets that one might have that would be career-threatening. One example might be lying about whether a person did or did not properly complete a physical training test. Why would that be significantly important to know the nature of the lie in this particular case? That is, if the members had sat there and speculated, well, she lied about something very, very important, cheating on a PT test, why wouldn't they have an adverse reaction to that, any different from the adverse reaction they might have to the specifics in this case?
Because the nature of the lie was very similar to what happened in this case. In the nature of the lie in both encounters was that she was going to be exposed to discipline because of her sexual conduct, that she was in fear of disclosure because the facts of that encounter were about to come out, and that her inclination in that sort of circumstance is to deny initially that the encounter was consensual and then say it was non-consensual. There was a direct link here, which is stronger, I think, than any of the precedent that we've cited in our brief, to the proposed cross and the defense's theory of the case. Much stronger than in Collier, stronger, I think, than in Barr, and stronger than in Williams. All cases where this court has found a constitutional violation of the defendant's Sixth Amendment right.
But counsel, part of the problem in Collier was that the majority found was that the military judge had failed to make findings, failed to do any balancing whatsoever in his ruling on the issue. In contrast, the military judge here did quite a bit of balancing, and unless you need to point to us why it was completely an abuse of discretion.
Well,
the fact that you disagree with him or that one of us might have ruled differently doesn't mean it was an abuse of discretion.
Well, there's two things on that. One, we argue that the court looks at this de novo because it is a constitutional question. But regardless, it's the same result. I think it's flawed in a number of respects. One, the judge relied heavily on the prejudice argument, and he said that the prejudice of this sort of evidence, mainly the prejudice to the accuser, would outweigh the probative value. Well, in fact, this court made very clear in Collier that the prejudice is to the integrity of the proceedings, not to any one particular party or witness.
But Banker included that prejudice within the gambit of the analysis. You're not contesting that.
No, that's true, but Banker was a different factual circumstance.
But are you arguing it's not a factor, the privacy of the victim, or that it's that too much weight was given to it in this case?
Too much weight was given to the victim and protecting the victim's rights in this case, and not enough weight was given to protect.
Not that it shouldn't be weighed.
Not that it shouldn't be weighed, but too much, and not enough to protecting the rights of the accused and making sure he had a fair trial.
Well, what about the language in the military judge's ruling that he's concerned that that having conflicting information on this point could easily sidetrack members from testimony regarding the charged offenses, and that despite limiting instruction, that they would consider it for improper purposes? That doesn't sound like protection of the alleged victim.
But I think
it sounds like protection of the process.
No, I think what he was talking about was that they would have a tendency to prove that Cadet SR's character for truthfulness, that she was a bad person, and that the members would view her in a bad light if they knew that she had had a prior consensual relationship and claimed that it was non-consensual. Focus at that point in time should have been on what's the defense's theory and how closely does this align with the defense's theory. And there's almost complete overlap, we would argue, much stronger again than the cases that we have cited.
Is that the criterion? How well it comports with the defense's theory? Or is the criterion what's in 412? Or do you have to balance it? Or I know how you want it to come out, but you're saying that the closer it is to the defense's theory, the more weight it gets, and the less weight the interests that 412 was promulgated to protect carry. Is that fair?
That's right. And I think that's bared out in the case law, when the courts repeatedly say, when you have a case where especially a he said, she said, no physical evidence, not no report of the alleged assault right away, not until almost 4 months later. All of these facts make the government's case here much weaker than it would normally be. And in that sort of situation, the ability to cross-examine on something like the accuser's credibility in this respect, which is very similar, when she had done something recently very similar to what we were alleging she was doing here, was critical. There's no way we can say that the member's version of or assessment of her credibility would not have been altered if they had heard this testimony. And one other point I'd like to make, it wouldn't have taken much more. It could have very well, easily been limited. The underlying sexual encounter had really very little to do with the proposed line of cross. It was all about the lie. So yes, they would have heard that there was a prior sexual encounter that she had said was non-consensual, but they wouldn't have had to get into the facts of that underlying sexual encounter. And that's what 412 was designed to prevent, embarrassment and degrading lines of cross based on a prior sexual conduct. That wouldn't have happened here. Only a few more questions would have needed to be asked. She admitted she lied to the appellant. We just needed to know that that lie pertained to a very similar circumstance and was very recent in time to when she lied about the appellant.
In paragraph 4, the military judge appears to be making the conclusion of law that the probative value was not strong because of the source of the information and because the victim's testimony was consistent throughout, and that therefore the probative value of the evidence was low. Do you agree or disagree that that is a conclusion that the military judge is entitled to make?
The military judge can make assessments of credibility at these hearings, but in this situation, I think that was an error for him to do it. One, the only evidence that was put forward was Cadet Smith's recollection of what occurred, because Cadet SR had invoked her Article 31B right not to testify and then been allowed to testify at trial. She was able to use, and the government was able to use, the secret as both a sword and a shield. It was the reason, the basis of an extortionist plot by the defendant, but yet the defendant was unable to show that that same secret was what had provided her with a motive to fabricate her story against him. I reserve 5 minutes on the line.
Thank you, counsel. You have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Efron and judges of the court. May it please the court, I am Lieutenant Reuter, and today with Commander Cleary, I represent the United States. I apologize for my voice, I have a cold.
I think we're in the same situation.
Your Honor, first to address the jurisdictional aspect of this case, the Sparks case does not overcome the ruling in United States v. Rodriguez. United States v. Rodriguez specifically ruled that court promulgated rules and case law that was not based on jurisdictional statutory authority does not create an exemption to the statutory authority of Article 67 Bravo.
Counsel, is there anything in the record that shows when the accused, the appellant, or his counsel were notified of the denial of reconsideration?
Yes, Your Honor, there is.
In other words, what I'm really asking, are you arguing a 61-day case or a 95-day case?
We're arguing a 95-day case, Your
Honor.
Okay,
you're not arguing. The government's position is not that more than 60 days elapsed between the denial of the notification, the denial of reconsideration, and the filing of the petition.
No, Your Honor, that is correct. However, okay. To the extent that that Rule 34 of this Court's rules and procedures cannot overcome the within 60 days statutory wording of Article 67.
I understand your argument about reconsideration. I'm looking at something else because it appears that 61 days elapsed, but I don't know when he was notified, when notice was sent.
Yeah, and we filed, and it was accepted an attachment with the notification. It was 61 days because of the next day business rule. However, under Rodriguez, there's also no authority to grant an extension for a next day business rule because Article 67.
What are you saying? You seem to say you're not arguing this, and now you say you are. Are you arguing the point you had in your brief, which is that the reconsideration rule is illegitimate under Rodriguez?
Yes, Your Honor, we are.
That's all you're arguing?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Counsel, just to be clear, I thought you sounded like you were also arguing that the 61 days was also a violation of Rodriguez.
Your Honor, the government would agree that it would be. However, the main point of our brief was focused on the petition for reconsideration. However, the government would submit that the next day business rule falls under the same category as the Rule 34 is extended.
So is the simple answer to Judge Stuckey's question, you're arguing both?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Where does the government have the authority to provide service by a private carrier, DHL? This rule seems to pretty clearly mention the U.S. Postal Service.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's the government has acknowledged that sending DHL next day delivery was substantial compliance, not actual compliance. However, the other part of that rule does allow for the time to start ticking once there's actual delivery. The appellant did receive actual delivery just several days after it was mailed by DHL, and in that case, you're still looking at being outside of the 60-day statutory period. Looking at the granted issue, the military judge did not violate the appellant's right to confront his accuser. The cross-examination of SR was only limited in regards to the issue protected under Military Rule of Evidence 412. The military judge conducted a proper hearing under MRE 412, and his decision that the appellant did not meet his burden to establish that the proffered evidence qualified under an exception to the general prohibition against the introduction of a victim's prior sexual history was properly within his discretion.
What about letting the members know what the secret was, putting aside cross-examination? Didn't they need to know what the secret was in order to assess whether a person of the same grade and in the same place would in fact consent to these acts in order to protect the secret?
No, Your Honor.
Human beings are very different. Some would die to protect the most routine kind of information, and other people would say, ho-hum, have at it. How can you, just telling someone there's a secret, who knows?
Well, and that is why the military judge specifically allowed the information to come out that the secret pertained to something that SR believed would jeopardize her cadet career or possibly result in discipline.
So a uniform infraction, perhaps. If you were at West Point, a button was loose, my goodness, you could be walking drill on the weekend.
Yes, Your Honor. Article 20.
So that might lead to someone being willing to have sex and to avoid having someone know that? You see what I'm getting at. I'm not trying to create stupid hypotheticals, but rather, how do you know without knowing what the secret is? There's a lot of things in the military that can lead to discipline.
Correct, Your Honor. And Article 127 does not require proof that the threat would have been successful. It does say that the threat can be based on the threat to reveal a secret that affects the victim. And in this case, the judge recognized that the magnitude of that secret would be important to inquire into, which is why he allowed extensive inquiry in cross-examination into the fact that SR believed that the secret did jeopardize her cadet career, could result in discipline, and that she was afraid of the rumors that were coming out and wanted them stopped, which sufficiently gives members the ability to assess how the victim perceived her secret.
Why isn't the issue how the members perceived the secret? That is, how the members perceived whether or not this would have a bearing on whether someone would tell or lie or the truth when confronted with what at least the defense was arguing was a similar situation.
Yeah, they were able to hear how SR, how strongly she felt about the secret. And so they were able to understand her feelings and her perceptions of what this secret was. The military judge ruled that the underlying secret, the sexual conduct, was not similar to the conduct that was, or the situation which led to the accusation against Cadet Smith, which is why the military judge didn't rule on their MRE 412. MRE 412 is a rule of exclusion, and the burden is on the proponent of the evidence to overcome those exclusionary rules.
If the judge was wrong in that regard, and I'm not asking you to concede that he was wrong with respect to the similarity, is there any other way that the government can prevail in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Without conceding that there was an error, under the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis, the military judge allowed cross-examination that was so extensive that the appellant was able to promote his theory of impeachment. The only thing that the appellant could not ask SR about was the exact details of her secret, the fact that it involved sex with an enlisted member. They were able to bring out the fact that she was in a situation that she believed violated cadet standards and also the UCMJ, that there were rumors and that she didn't want those rumors to persist because she was afraid of getting in trouble.
This is a he said, she said case, and she's the only witness. How can this possibly be harmless if it was error to keep it out? If it was, assuming arguendo, it was our error to keep it out, how can this possibly be harmless error?
Because in this situation, Your Honor, they were allowed to fully explore the theory that SR had lied about misconduct in the past and that she wanted to, and she did that to try to stop rumors. They were able to bring all of that information out on their cross-examination. At that point, the fact that what she was lying about was sex, there was very little probative value. The crux of...
Well, how do you answer the appellant's contention that it's not so much that what she was lying about was sex, but the consensual nature of the sex?
They were able to bring out in cross-examination that she was in a situation that she was misleading to the appellant, or she admitted that she lied to the appellant about the nature of this situation in order to try to suppress these rumors. And so the members had more than adequate information to assess the fact that she was involved in some sort of situation that she lied about in order to try to stay out of trouble.
Returning to Judge Baker's earlier question, why wouldn't it be important for the trier of fact to know what the substance of the secret was in order to assess whether it was that it was true beyond a reasonable doubt that the extortion occurred in order to protect that secret?
Again, Your Honor, Article 127, the judge recognized that, which is why he allowed the magnitude of the secret to come out and in terms of what the secret involved. It was the judge's determination that gave adequate information to the members, the fact that it involved the UCMJ, the fact that she was afraid of these rumors, the fact that it would affect her cadet standing, that provides adequate information to the members about the magnitude of the secret. The judge's concern was that under Military Rule of Evidence 412, generally prior sexual conduct cannot be admissible for the, out of concern of the victims, right to privacy and the concern that that information will be used to show that because she consented to sex in a prior occasion, that she was consenting to sex in this occasion. And under the United States v. Banker, it specifically addresses that, you know, the burden is on the proponent of the evidence to present the evidence and the theory of admissibility to the military judge. If that burden is not met, it is within the judge's discretion to limit or exclude that evidence.
So I guess my question then is it the government's position that the military judge got it exactly right and this was the preferred outcome, or is it the government's position that the military judge didn't abuse his discretion, or both, or some other
position? It was both, Your Honor. The military judge absolutely did not abuse his discretion. The reason why he did not abuse his discretion was because the evidence that was proffered to him did not support the motive proffered, or excuse me, the theory of admissibility given to him, which was that the victim, because she lied in this instance, had a propensity to make false accusations in cases where she was afraid of.
What about paragraph 3 of the judge's findings? The judge seemed to indicate that there was a different theory, which was the members needed this information in order to assess whether someone would in fact engage in sex to protect such a secret. Putting aside all that stuff about whether she lied or didn't lie about anything else.
Well, and that was the judge's determination, Your Honor, that the extent of her secret and this prior conduct could be revealed in terms of that it was a violation of the UCMJ. However, looking at United States v. Sanchez, it says when the appellant is looking to admit evidence under the constitutionally required exception, that if they're looking at pattern, it must be a distinctive pattern or particularly unusual. And in this case, when the judge first asked for evidence,
that's not a pattern issue, that's a fair trial issue. Two separate things. Lying is a pattern issue. This is was this necessary for the members to know in order to have a fair trial?
Is there a
separate theory here?
The military judge did determine, or he did allow that there was a pattern of lying to come out, or that she had lied on a prior occasion. However, he determined that he was doing the balancing test of this prior sexual occasion where SR was less than truthful to a friend, to approach her in a friend capacity when there were no investigations going on, only rumors, but no kind of actual imminent fear of being in trouble, that was not similar enough to a situation in the appellant's case where SR gave a statement to CJIS, the appellant had been investigated for at least 2 months, and it was clear that there was an investigation going on around to this conduct. So his determination was that because it was so dissimilar, it was not probative and it's not vital to his defense and not constitutionally required.
The order of revelation in the first instance here was, just to review, first consensual and then non-consensual.
The testimony of Cadet Smith was that she originally told him it was non-consensual. And when asked what she specifically said, he said that to the effect that she'd engaged in oral sex with this other partner and then stopped because she felt bad, and then he engaged with oral sex with her, and then she forced his head away. And at that point, that was the evidence that the judge had before him of how this prior sexual occasion would or should be allowed in. When he asked about whether there was evidence of this other partner or actual evidence outside of rumors, none was produced to him. He was told that investigators were down in Norfolk, but they didn't know the name of this partner, and they had, despite their claim that SR had also been lying to others, they proffered no other witnesses saying that she lied to them about this prior sexual occasion.
The defense theory, as picked up by the judge, was and is argued on appeal, is this theory of inoculation. That is, that the victim in this case sought to inoculate herself against investigations on two separate occasions. In what manner was that theory brought out by the evidence at trial that the judge allowed to be admitted?
The judge allowed it to be admitted that SR believed that her conduct violated the UCMJ and that the appellant was going to affect rumors or try to suppress these rumors about her conduct, and that she desired him to do that, and that she was worried that if this conduct got out, her cadet career would be jeopardized. The military judge did not...
But did that allow the defense to then argue a theory of inoculation, that is, that when faced with rumors that the victim in this case, in the defense theory, lied about it in a manner that would try to minimize her own culpability?
Yes, Your Honor, it did. And in fact, in cross-examination, SR did admit that she had lied, and it was pertaining to this prior conduct that she thought violated the UCMJ. They had that available to them, and the military judge...
But did it come out that it was done in order to minimize culpability?
Certainly, many questions were asked about why she would want the rumors suppressed, and the fact, and whether or not the defense brought that out through their own questions is not relevant. They were allowed to do that. The fact that they did not do that is not a result of this ruling that says that they could not bring up her sex or her prior sexual conduct. That was their ability to, they had the ability to pursue their motive theory. It was limited within the bounds of 412. However, they were not prohibited from bringing up that theory on cross-examination. Whether or not they did or not is not within the bounds of the constitutionality of this rule or the correctness of this rule. They certainly had that opportunity because the judge did so narrowly tailor his ruling. And also, the allegations of gamesmanship of SR are unfounded. First of all, the fact that SR was read her rights was done at the military judge's instruction, and he puts this on the record at JA-100. SR had the ability to talk to defense counsel and trial counsel before she did this. And certainly, if defense counsel believed that SR's testimony would have supported their burden in this motion hearing, they could have requested immunity, which they never did. Once at trial, nothing that SR testified to required the judge to revisit his ruling. First of all, he made the determination that even if SR had claimed to the appellant that the original sexual conduct was non-consensual, he still found that they were so dissimilar that it was not vital to the defense, did not require admittance. He also, there was no motion from the defense at the time of SR's testimony requesting that he revisit his ruling. In this case, the military judge carefully considered the evidence before him. There was, looking at in his within the judge's determination, the evidence that was given to him did not support the theory of admissibility that was proffered. Under an abuse of discretion standard, the military judge's ruling is proper unless it is arbitrary, fanciful, clearly unreasonable, or clearly erroneous.
Counsel, before your time runs out, I want to revisit jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you apply our Rule 19A to the denial of reconsideration, how much time elapsed under Right 19A between that and the filing of this petition?
95 days, Your Honor.
No. The denial of the petition for reconsideration. This is the 61 days.
Oh, correct, Your Honor.
If you apply 19A, where are we?
The Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals denied the motion for reconsideration on 14 May 2008.
Right. And was the appellant notified of that on 14 May, or was a copy of the denial deposited in the mail?
Yes,
or
sir.
What, on 14 May?
Your Honor, I don't have that specific information. I know our office policy is that there's electronic service requirements, so the council were notified on 14 May, and our policy is also generally to put out the mail.
Is it a matter of record that council were notified on 14 May?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it is.
Thank you.
However, I'd have to get back to you. If there are no further questions, I'll conclude.
You may take the time to summarize and conclude.
In this case, the appellant was allowed to pursue his impeachment theory, just not to the extent that he wished, which is consistent with Supreme Court case law that judges have wide latitude to limit cross-examination pertinent to relevant interests to the trial process. Under NRU 412, the judge conducted the proper analysis and was well within his discretion to limit this evidence. And for these reasons, the government respectfully requests that this court affirm the findings of the sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Had there been no cross-examination, how would it have been helpful to the defendant for the members to know what the secret was?
Had there been no cross-examination?
Correct.
It would have been helpful for the members to know that in the very recent past, the accuser had done the same thing to another man, to an enlisted man, that she was now trying to do to him.
But that wasn't the secret.
That the secret was that she had lied about.
No, the secret is that she had engaged in sex with a particular person in a particular place. Why would that have been helpful for the members to have known that was the secret?
The important part about, because it's the nature of that, it's the nature of that activity, that it's a sexual encounter. That's the important part, that she had engaged in a sexual encounter, and then it's coupled with the fact that she had lied about that being non-consensual. But that's why the secret is so important. That's what makes it so distinctive.
The secret, the pertinent thing is that it was a consensual sexual encounter.
It was consensual sexual encounter.
About which she initially lied.
That she initially lied, which shows her inclination with how she deals with these situations when they're about to become public.
Now, that wasn't my question, but
I'm sorry.
You've given your answer, which is that's why it's important.
But I'll try to take further questions. I want to go through the harmless error analysis. The government is only focused on one of the four factors. Obviously, the significance of the witness to the case is critical here. It was a one-witness case. There was no corroboration. The proposed line of cross was not cumulative of any other line of cross. As the Chief Judge indicated, the key factor here
It was a question, not a comment.
I'm sorry. But as you, I guess, indicated through your question, or implied through your question, what's important is how the members perceive the secret. That's what's so important. And here, we just don't know what the members would have done if they had known this, had this evidence before them, how devastating it could have been. We don't know, quite frankly. I mean, the government talks about the defense was able to talk about that there had been the secret. The government did that for a self-serving purpose. The secret was overplayed because the secret was the basis of the alleged extortionist plot. So by upplaying or overplaying the significance of the secret, the government really helped their case. It wasn't done to help the appellant. What was done to really deprive the appellant of their really only defense in this case was not allowing him to cross-examine about the nature of that, the fact that that secret, she had lied about it initially, and that encounter had actually been consensual when she had said it was non-consensual. I want to address the judge's question regarding the record on the jurisdictional argument. There's nothing in the record that we found that indicates that the accused was notified of the denial of reconsideration. So the 61-day argument that you were coming to, that just does, there's no basis for that argument. On the harmless error analysis again, Your Honor, again, there's four other factors. None of those were addressed. The important part about one of the issues that the military judge talks about, which is there a distinction between lying to the police and lying to an individual? Certainly, the case law doesn't recognize that distinction. In Barr, this court found that a false rape allegation to a friend was enough to be a constitutional violation of the Sixth Amendment right to cross-examine. And if there are no other questions, I'll just summarize.
Please go ahead.
Your Honors, Cadet Webster Smith has many dreams and aspirations. He has dreams of leading a successful life. He has aspirations of becoming an attorney. All of those dreams and aspirations were compromised by the verdicts in this case. And we can accept that. We're not asking for pity. We understand that if that verdict was the result and the consequences of the members' decisions based on a full review and assessment of all the evidence before them. But that's not what happened in this case. He was deprived of the principal means of defense by not being able to cross-examine the accuser about her motive to fabricate and her bias in this case. We'd ask the court to rectify this situation and reverse the counts and reduce Appellant Webster Smith's punishment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 9:30 a.m. on Tuesday, November 17th.